last week we've gone through quite a lot of formalism and sort of setting up a more mathematical side of GR. And then we started to see the formalism in action in terms of computing curvatures of types of metric and looking at, some examples on Friday of actually solving for GD6 in a curved manifold. So I was starting to think about what curvature meant. So what I want to do this week is sort of carry on with that theme and try and talk about either various useful space times or physical situations in gravity. And so I'll start off by going back again to black holes or to the Schwarzschild metric in particular and sort of re-deriving it. I know it's something you see a lot of, but that's because it's actually quite a sort of important sort of exact solution of vacuum Einstein gravity. So what I'd like to do is to use some of the things that we'd derived, so some of the tools that we've got, to find we'll sort of start off by just looking at the Schwarzschild metric, and then we'll look at some variants of the Schwarzschild metric. So what have we actually done calculationally? What did I do with you? Well, we saw, we derived this last week. I'd written down a very simple type of ansatz. I'd said, suppose I've got some, I'm now going to have my dimensionality to be d. Suppose I've got some arbitrary kind of d minus one dimensional metric, and then I add an extra dimension r on which there's a sort of dependence of the overall scaling of this lower d minus one dimensional metric. And then we found that if we computed the connection, it actually was fairly straightforward. And so I talked about, I think I used that as a way of talking about anti-de Sitter space or space-time with a negative cosmological constant by putting A equal to kr, sorry, e to the kr. So that was what we derived last week using the Cartan formalism. And I think you may have been asked to do that or to redo Friedman, Robertson, Walker using the same sort of method. And so today I just want to build on this, but to try and show you how you don't necessarily have to start from scratch each time you want to look at a new space-time. So here, we're going to take this as our template and then add some extra pieces to it and derive, well, the Schwarzschild solution as a specific example. So what we've got, or if you look at the patterns, and I want to try and bring out the patterns of this, we've got that, we've got this extra sort of proper distance on which we've got this warp factor depending, but the sort of internal structure here is coming out through this background curvature R naught, which is the curvature of this G mu nu. So this piece sort of feeds in here, but otherwise everything is just some derivatives of A. Another thing to notice is that anti de Sitter space here is where the Ricci tensor is some positive constant times delta AB, and so correspondingly de Sitter space would be minus this constant times delta AB. And so what that's telling you is a sort of more general, so a constant curvature space in fact, it's more than that. You tend to have the Riemann tensor also being product proportional to an appropriate combination of the metrics. But this is all I want for the moment, because what I want to do is to try and extend this by adding extra blocks. So, for example, in de Sitter space, you would see it where, more or less, this would be the dt squared piece. This would be some constant curvature space. That would be your cosmological sort of t equals constant spatial sections. And then this would be the scale factor, a squared of t. And so if you had e to the ht in here because of the sort of analytic continuation, that would be give you a negative sign here, and that would be an inflating universe. So let me just... So this is meant to just be delta AB, dxA, dxB. So that's obviously in four dimensions. So if we wanted to build up a more complicated space-time, sorry, let me call those Ys. So as a first step, I'm just going to add another block diagonal piece. So it's actually surprising just how many metrics can be built up of just adding together lots of building blocks, lots of little independent parts. So here I'm going to say that this is got p plus 1, so x runs from 0 to p, and over here, I'm going to say that's n-dimensional. So for Schwarzschild, or spherically symmetric metric, this would be the two-sphere, and you just have a dt here, okay? So if I want to now compute the curvature of the space-time, but I don't really have to go into an awful lot of detail. So the first comment is it's reasonably obvious that this block and this block don't mix at the level of computing the connection. So the mu and the alpha do not mix. So in other words, I'm going to use hats to emphasize the orthonormal basis. And then my individual one forms are just C times the one forms appropriate to gamma. And so I have theta alpha beta is theta naught alpha beta, and theta alpha r is C primed on C, omega alpha. So I'm not even calculating it because I'm using the work we've done over here. So for exactly the same reasons, if I block that out, this part, I would be able to just read off what the connection was. And so we can now relatively straightforwardly derive our new curvature two forms. So these are the new ones. So these are the ones that we would get if we were just scanning over what we'd actually done in the calculation over on this side for the warp metric. But then, because of the cross term in the Cartan second equation, where you've got r is d theta plus theta wedge theta, you can see that because we've got a theta alpha r and a theta, well, I've called it A here, but I'm going to call it mu hat. There is going to be an additional sort of cross term coming from the theta wedge theta piece, sum over theta mu r cross theta r alpha. So now I have to peel off the Riemann tensor. So some of this we did last time, so I'm really just writing stuff down again. So the only slight thing to note, which is sort of not just a direct copy of the warp results, is just a sort of little sneaky minus sign hiding in there. And that's simply because what you really want here is the components of the metric. So here we've got G nu tau. But for the alpha beta part, I've pulled out the minus sign actually in front. So actually G alpha beta is minus the gamma alpha beta, so I'm just in case you'd spotted it. It's probably too early in the morning to spot something like that, but I thought I'd say it. Okay, so that's kind of not a lot, just a lot of writing long equations down on the board. But what I've actually got there through just not really thinking, actually, just sort of more or less repetition, doing something, I've got one building block, I add another, I more or less just copy or duplicate the information, swapping symbols or indices. And then the only bit I had to add was this this cross term in the curvature. And so here, I've now got in a very general metric, which will describe for me, in any number of dimensions, objects that have some sort of subspaces of symmetry. So I've got a space which is on the left, the P plus one dimensional space, that's kind of something which talks to itself through the G and then sees the extra dimensions through the warp factor, A of R. And on the right-hand side, I've got this gamma, which is, again, talks to itself through through the gamma, which depends only on Y, and then sees the other part of the metric through that warp factor, A of R. So the metrics that get used, for example, in solutions in string theory, or just either black brains or the D brains, all have that form. So you, in many cases, that gamma part is actually some sort of internal Calabi-Yau type of metric. And then the warp factor is simply something that's telling you how that changes as you move through R. So it's a very, that template is very useful, gives you pretty much most of the metrics that you'll meet at least on the formal end of gravity. And it does at least have the universe included in it in some sense, so it's not entirely useless. So that now gives you sort of quite a general setup. So let's start looking at specifics. I said we'd get the Schwarzschild solution, so where's that? It's hiding in there. So I take four dimensions, P equals zero, N equals two, and obviously my gamma is going to be the metric on a two sphere. Now, for convenience, I'm just going to rewrite that radial coordinate as rho because we have a sort of inbuilt prejudice about what R means. So this is our spherically symmetric static metric. Here, it's telling us that gamma is the metric on a two-sphere. And so R naught alpha beta is actually going to be gamma alpha beta. It's Euclidean, it's a constant positive curvature, and for Euclidean positive curvature, R naught is plus. So here, if I just read off what I get, I've got three equations. And so if I set them all to zero, it'll give me a vacuum solution. So this is, in fact, Schwarzschild, just in slightly odd coordinates, where I've revised my radial coordinate. Instead of meaning something to do with the area of the two spheres, my radial coordinate is now measuring proper distance as I move out. So let's just convince ourselves this is, in fact, Schwarzschild. If I look at the first equation, if I set that to zero, I can see that that is, in fact, a total derivative, and it's the total derivative of c squared a primed. So the first equation is telling me that a primed is some constant over c squared. That's kind of looking promising, because if we wanted to change our radial coordinate and set c equal to r, then, you know, we're sort of seeing this mu on r squared coming up as a sort of derivative there. And then if I take 1 and 2 combined, so that tells me that c double primed on c is equal to a prime c prime on ac. And so what that tells me is that c primed is proportional to A. But now if I demand that my metric is asymptotically flat, what does that mean? Well, the bottom line means that if I go far enough away radially, it looks like flat space, more or less. It's sort of more technical ways of putting it. But that means that this thing is now going to be rho squared. If this were flat, A would be 1 and C would be rho. Yep.
So what assumption are you using to get
I'm not using any assumptions. I'm just integrating up. So I'm set. I'm looking for a vacuum solution.
Oh.
Yep. For the moment, I'm just trying to get Schwarzschild. So although in reality, I mean, okay, I'm looking for a vacuum solution, but that first equation would just require that t naught naught minus a half t vanished. So if my metric is asymptotically flat, c goes to rho and a goes to 1, and therefore lambda is equal to 1. So now I know what c primed is, it's equal to a, and I know what a primed is, it's just mu on c squared. And so if I define r equals c, then dr is c prime d rho, which is just a d rho. And so I see that d rho squared now gets replaced by dr squared on a squared. So that's looking very familiar. So you see that in terms of the choice of gauge, the way the metric looks, it looks like Schwarzschild. I've got minus r squared times the two sphere, and I've got a squared dt squared minus dr squared on a squared. And so the final step is just to determine what A is. And so here, that's dA d rho. So dA d rho is equal to A dA dr. And that's equal to mu on r squared. And so A is 1 minus 2 mu on r. So that is our standard Schwarzschild solution, provided mu goes to GM. So that's Schwarzschild. What happens if I relax that assumption of vacuum? So let's look at adding a cosmological constant. So if I add in a cosmological constant, then now I can't say that A prime is mu on C squared anymore, because RTT is going to equal minus lambda. But what I can say is, because a cosmological constant means that your energy momentum is proportional to the metric, RTT is still equal to RRR. Therefore, the second step, A prime C prime on AC equals C double prime on C, is still true. So I still have that relation, C prime being lambda A. And once again, although you don't have asymptotic flatness, you can choose a gauge to set lambda equals 1 simply by rescaling T. So now, if I look at the third equation, or rather look at what's left, so C primed is just A, so I've got this term becoming A primed on C. This gives me A squared on C squared, so that's this part here. And then, of course, C double primed on C and the A prime C prime are still the same, so that's why there's two copies of this. Actually, not minus. But if I look at the right-hand side, I want to do the same thing again and set R equal to C. So I multiply through, C squared, that's an R. I've basically here taken a derivative with respect to C. And so that tells me, you can see that A squared is going to be 1. That's just comes from cancelling that term off there. I integrate up here. I get minus lambda over 3 r cubed. I divide by r. And then once again, I get a constant, which I'm going to choose to be gm, in analogy with Schwarzschild. And so I find that my potential is now modified by a term proportional to R squared. Cool. Yeah? So going from the first line to the second line. So in terms of, so here I've set on the right-hand side, you can sort of see that I've got, if I multiply, so A primed is dA d rho. So if I've got, if I look, d by d rho is C prime d by dr, right? So the 2A prime there is really 2C prime dA dr, right? But then the C primed is A, so it's 2A dA dr. And so that's the derivative of A squared, right? And then with respect to R, and then, of course, the derivative of R with respect to R is just 1. So I'm really setting C equal to R and then differentiating with respect to R. So that's sort of, if you look at that middle strip, you see how I've done it with Schwarzschild, yeah? I've said, okay, I'm going to define my radial coordinate to be C. In that case, you know, my derivatives with respect to rho are now multiplied by an A to get derivatives with respect to R. And so what that right-hand side becomes is the derivative of A squared with respect to R divided by R. So now I multiply through the whole equation by R squared. So that's where the minus lambda R squared comes from. And then if you look at the left-hand side, if I differentiate with respect to R, I get A squared minus 1, which is the second term. And then I've got to take the derivative of A squared. So it's all there. Yep. Oh, yeah, that should be an A squared. Thanks. Typo. Absolutely, because it's A squared in the metric. There you go. Because you can see that anyway from dA d rho is A dA dr. Right. So in this case, it's sort of obvious that if I take lambda goes to zero, I get the Schwarzschild solution. So, because we just did that, we did it with lambda zero first, yeah?
So you put lambda equals one using right?
Oh, the little lambda.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was wondering, why could we not use the same argument there?
Because you don't have asymptotic flatness with a cosmological constant. So it's really to do about gauge choice. I could have just said, I choose my time scaling to set lambda equal to 1 for the Schwarzschild case, except in the case of Schwarzschild, there's a physical meaning to what that value of lambda is. And that is, if I go far enough away from a gravitating object, if I'm just sort of standing there watching it, I have a particular, you know, my clock ticks at a certain rate, okay? And so that would be dt. Okay? So there's a meaning there. The meaning is it's the rate of the clock of the observer who's far away from your system in flat space where the clock goes at a certain rate. Okay? So it's ticking at a certain rate. And similarly, if I looked at the rest, the spatial part, if I was in a flat space, that ought to look locally like dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, which that does, except obviously in polar coordinates. So in the case of Schwarzschild, I have meaning to that, or at least I can assign some meaning to it. The trouble with Schwarzschild de Sitter, or when you have a cosmological constant, is that you don't have this asymptotic flat space anymore. So far away from r equals zero, you're now in one of these inflating universes with exponential expansion. So your time there, if you like, if you wanted to play the same trick, you would say, well, actually, as I go far away, shouldn't I be taking cosmological time? Which you could, but that's actually not this time. Okay, it's a bit of a mess. Well, not that much of a mess, but... So for convenience, I think, we say that this is... that lambda is 1, because... we then do have this nice correspondence that if I set lambda to zero continuously, I recover my Schwarzschild spacetime. So it's a very natural thing to do. And then if I set GM going to zero, I actually do get de Sitter space, or anti-de Sitter space, I suppose. But now it's in static coordinates. So that really does look, where did I write it down? Over there at the top, where I wrote down de Sitter space in a cosmological way. It does look very different from that, but they are in fact the same space. So what this particular coordinate choice has done, it's here you can see that as r tends to root 3 on lambda, gtt tends to 0, grr blows up. And so what we have is something analogous to our r equals 2 gm Schwarzschild event horizon, and this is a cosmological event horizon. So these static coordinates bring out the fact that you have a cosmological event horizon in de Sitter spacetime. So they are perhaps more like an individual observer oriented. So I want to just note that this particular solution for a squared has that one. I want to focus on the constant term for a moment. So if lambda is positive or zero, we actually need that one there. And it's something that you don't, at least initially, you don't necessarily think about because it's one. It's not lambda or kappa or whatever. And so you just sort of assume it's got to be there. But what it's doing is it's actually providing an event horizon by having that positive constant one sitting there. You're ensuring that there's always at least one real root to that polynomial for a squared. In other words, you get an event horizon. And the usefulness of that is we know that as soon as m is non-zero, r equals zero is a physical singularity. Your Riemann curvature is proportional to gm on r cubed, the piece coming from the black hole. And so that blows up as r goes to zero. Therefore, having a coordinate singularity, which we interpret as an event horizon, protects us from the implications of the singularity. And so it's a good thing. However, if lambda is less than zero, then I've got 1 plus something times r squared. So I don't actually need that 1 to get a real root for my event horizon. So where did it come from? So the one came from integrating up that a squared minus one. So it came from the one over c squared piece. And so if I track that back, the one over c squared piece in here actually came from, if I can spot it relatively easily. I'm not sure I can at this point. It comes from, it's over here. That's why I can't spot it. It comes from here. So here's where the 1 over c squared piece is coming from. It's coming from the fact that we're dealing with a constant positive curvature space, the 2 sphere. So that's where this comes from. It comes from the r naught alpha beta. If I'd instead of having a 2 sphere, I'd put the planar metric, dx squared plus dy squared, or even a hyperbolic metric, a negatively curved space, I would have, in the case of the planar choice, nothing here, so no 1 over c squared piece, or, in fact, a negative 1 over c squared. sorry, R naught. So you see this when you do cosmology and you have a general cosmological metric, your Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. You have, over there, I've actually written it as being flat, which is why I had the nice, simple exponential solution on that top left-hand board. But I could also have put positive curvature or negative curvature. So if you've sort of followed any of the, or you've read into cosmology at all, you'll know that although we believe the universe is flat, you know, strictly speaking, from the symmetries that we have, it could be slightly hyperbolic, so slightly open, or slightly closed, but we think it's flat. But that's really the same sort of thing is coming here. And so if I chose this, my a squared would go to kappa minus lambda on 3r squared minus 2gm on r. And so for a negative lambda, I can choose my kappa to be whatever I want. So I can have spherical black holes, I can have planar black holes, or I can have hyperbolic black holes. So anti-de Sitter space really is quite different from our sort of normal or positive energy type of space times. So you get some different things happening. So I just want to want to spend the last couple of minutes, and I think I've managed to completely do this in. I just want to spend the last few minutes doing something that might seem a little bit weird, unless you've seen it before. And I want to talk about Euclidean metrics, but in the context of the black hole metric, at least initially. So you'll kind of see why, once I've finished discussing this, why I'm actually doing this. But what do I mean by Euclidean? Well, our normal space times are based on causality. So it's based on the idea that we experience time as a very different dimension from space. So even though Einstein's relativity tells us that space and time are not really separate quantities, it's certainly true that our perception of the dimensions is very different. So we see spatial distances all at once, and we measure them in a very direct sense. But in terms of time, although we also can often be quite obsessed about measuring time, in fact, it's something that we tend to feel, or we feel the passage of time rather than so much directly measuring it. Well, I suppose I could just stand and watch my clock or something. But. And so we have this notion that time is very much distinct from space, and then causality is simply telling us that no signal travels faster than the speed of light. Or in other words, the null cone, the set of points from that the light rays, that the null geodesics from an individual point can reach, the null cone represents the sort of boundary of the region of space-time that any particular observer can influence from a certain time. So in Euclidean, but it's in Euclidean metrics instead, we don't want to single out time. We put time and space on the same footing, and we want a metric that's positive definite. So in other words, our space-time really is what, you know, mathematicians or would be more comfortable with, where distances are always positive, and the only way they can be zero is if the two points actually coincide. So we get this, we can either get it by sending t to I tau, or, and then reversing, given that I've chosen that mostly minus signature, I would reverse the sign of my metric. So I'm analytically continuing, so this should be very familiar from field theory, from our real time into imaginary time. So at the moment, this is just something formal. So what happens to my Schwarzschild black hole? Well, it looks just the same. Now, although when I wrote down my rather general metric and computed the curvature, the Lorentzian nature of the metric did sort of feed in terms of the odd sign here and there, the structure of the Ricci tensor is pretty much the same. I suppose it would depend if you were differentiating with respect to time. But if you've got a solution to the vacuum Einstein's equations in the Lorentzian section, it's also going to be a solution in the Euclidean section. So basically that I've written down is a Ricci flat metric. So I don't, you know, I don't have to sort of recompute. I mean, we don't have a physical interpretation of that. But it's still a flat metric. So what happens now as r goes to 2gm? So let's just look at this as some abstract curve manifold. So in my Lorentzian Schwarzschild metric, I know that r equals 2gm is not a physical singularity, and it's just a coordinate singularity. And I can demonstrate that by shifting coordinates. And so what we're going to insist is that this metric here, this Euclidean metric, has also just got a coordinate singularity. So let me look at what happens as r tends to 2gm. I'm just going to focus on the TR part of the metric. So if I look at this, if I want to make this non-singular, the first thing I notice is actually I could integrate up here and just change my r coordinate. So this would be the integral dr over root of r minus 2gm. So I'm going to guess and that I have a new radial coordinate, which is going to be something like the square root of r minus 2gm. Then that tells me that d rho is going to be lambda dr divided by 2 rho. And so I see that I've got that dr squared, d rho squared would equal dr squared on r minus 2gm times 2gm. If I have a very specific value for lambda, so that means that what I've done is I've just shifted radial coordinate so that I've now got proper distance, rho is proper distance, away from this 2gm surface. So now let's look at the tau part of the metric here. So this looks like r minus 2gm is just rho squared on 8gm. So I have a rho squared there. There's another 2gm on the bottom. So that's d tau squared over 16 g squared m squared. So that's my first piece. And then my second piece is just the d rho squared. So that's actually now looking like a coordinate singularity. So this is the normal polar singularity. If I insist that the periodicity of my Euclidean time is 8 pi gm. So I've now got polar coordinates and periodic time with the periodicity proportional to the mass term in that metric. So then I'm in an interesting situation. That my Euclidean time is periodic. Now, I'm just going to state it, which you have to take on trust, is that this is a situation that occurs when you try and do field theory at finite temperature. So having a periodic Euclidean time is the same as putting a system at a finite temperature and then, but in this case, your temperature goes like 1 over the periodicity. So T is 1 over 8 pi gm. And so this is something which is slightly curious if you just saw it from the perspective of looking at the Euclidean metric. But of course, given that we know that in 1974, I think, Stephen Hawking showed that if you put a quantum field theory on the curved background of a Lorentzian Schwarzschild black hole, then out at future null infinity, the black hole looks like it's radiating thermally at a temperature inversely proportional to the mass. We actually have this now as a nice alternative description of a black hole representing a system at finite temperature by simply looking at the periodicity of Euclidean time. So this was, I guess this interpretation is due to Gibbons and Hawking. Who spotted quite a nice correspondence with black hole thermodynamics, looking at a Euclidean approach, a Euclidean path integral approach, which we'll probably do sometime either later this week or early next week. And so if I put in all my constants, it's got to be an H bar. I actually see that the temperature of a black hole is really, really tiny. So let me just wrap up by sketching what this Euclidean metric looks like. So what we've done is we know far away we've got something that looks flat, d tau squared plus dr squared plus the two-sphere standard r squared d omega 2. But we know that tau is periodic. So far away, we've got a cylinder in tau r space, over which we've got a two-sphere, which is the theta and phi part, where the two, so this is really just take flat space, slice, cut out a slice of width 8 pi gm, and identify. So it's like a cylinder far away. But we also know that as we come down to r equals 2 gm, our cylinder has to round off into a local polar coordinate singularity. And so it has to round off like this. And sitting over 2 gm will be a two-sphere of radius 2 gm. And so our space-time is topologically called a Euclidean black hole cigar. It's topologically S2 cross R2. The S2 from the, obviously, the theta phi part. And so that's geometrically what our space-time looks like. So flat space at finite temperature, on the other hand, would have topology R3 cross S1, the S1 coming from the periodic time. So that's what I want to say today. Tomorrow, we're going to move on, sort of thinking again about, we've done a lot with vacuum space-time, so I want to start thinking about having fields on our space-time and how, from a classical perspective, and what sort of gravitating solutions do we have once we've got some matter present. Yeah. Sorry? Well, it doesn't. The point is that if you looking at it from the perspective of this geometry here, if you tried to make R less than 2 gm, this factor would be negative. And so there's a change of signature across R equals 2 gm. And so that's something that sort of should be ringing serious alarm bells. So the other in the standard Schwarzschild metric, the Lorentzian Schwarzschild metric, the signature doesn't change. It's still plus, minus, minus, minus. It's just that the radial coordinate and the time coordinate have flipped. And if we do an analytic extension using Kruskal coordinates, we see how that happens. So we see that the event horizon is simply where those coordinates kind of break down and sort of swap roles. And if we shifted our definition of time using some local non-singular frame, then the metric would go from, I guess, depending on being a sort of static-looking metric to being something that was more analogous to a cosmological type of metric. Well, that sort of interpretation. So in the Lorentzian case, the signature doesn't change and the space-time is not singular. So in this case, that's really what's telling us that we are less than 2 gm is not in our manifold. Our manifold is Euclidean. It stops at 2 gm. And so we have to change coordinates because obviously the radial coordinate should stop at 2 gm. And so this is just a convenient way of doing that. No, that was the whole point of doing this. The fact that we want the manifold to be completely regular, so it smoothly closes off, as I've sketched there with the cigar, and so that's what the manifold looks like. It's totally regular. It's this smooth cigar in the R tau plane, and then you've got the sort of near the tip region it topologically just looks like a bit of the plane with the two spheres sitting over it, not changing too much in area. If you look at the other region far away, it's just like flat space with this identification. So the whole thing is completely smooth. And if you try to find geodesics on the space-time, you'll simply see that they'll sort of come in, kind of, if you put one exactly radial, it'll sort of come in and come back out again. But that's not a dynamical process because there's no time here. This is just a one path. In fact, that's not a geodesic at all, is it? Because a geodesic would do that again. I suppose there's a competition. There's a homework or a tutorial. Figure out what the geodesics are, what's the shortest path. Yeah, I've got to watch out because that's just a topological sketch, not a metric sketch.